Welcome, everyone, to Film Strips, the podcast in which we discover what I consider to be filmic catnip. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kangeuser.
Yes, so welcome back, folks. We're very happy you decided to return after the rather somber and heavy episode that we just had last week.
We stopped recording. We're basically like, well, somehow we've managed to suck all the fun out of this and become every other film analysis podcast out there.
So, yeah, with that said, I think it was time to decide to do something a little more fun this week. So as ever, for those who are joining us for the first time, this is the show in which every film under discussion has to somehow connect back to the film that preceded it. So last week we talked about Samuel Fuller's White Dog, a film which had Dick Miller as part of its cast, however briefly. And we have followed Dick Miller back to 1962, finally getting us out of the 82 after 2 weeks there, to take a look at Roger Corman's The Premature Burial, based on the 1844 story by one Edgar Allan Poe. And yeah, I would say that a film about, you know, being buried alive, you know, catalepsy and general all-around psychosis is somehow infinitely lighter than what we were talking about last week.
Well, yeah, because it doesn't connect to anything real and embodied. But yeah, as David indicated, like when you're trying to connect films to one another, there's always a lot of places you can go. And, I find that generally we always try and keep somewhat of a balance here. That's why, touch wood, hopefully we'll never have to do like four different Shakespeare adaptations in a row. Sometimes you find those interesting point counterpoints that happen organically. And here we're like, okay, well, we can talk about Roger Corman films from the 60s. That's bound to be at least a little bit more freewheeling and lighter, both to watch and for you folks at home to listen to.
Yeah, so I guess this brings us to the film itself for this week. So I guess to get things started, Andrew, prior to this, have you heard of The Premature Burial?
I probably read it way back when. Like most grown-up nerds that had difficulty socializing in high school, I was an avid reader, and especially being interested in Stephen King and that whole vein of pulpy horror, it was only a matter of time before I encountered the work of Edgar Allan Poe. So I think at one point I read like just his entire short story collection. So it was definitely in there, but I can't pretend that it was memorable enough that when you proposed it, I'm like, oh, I remember that one in pristine detail. So this, it's probably, well, it's certainly far less celebrated as a film and as a source story than, say, The Pit and the Pendulum, The Mask of the Red Death, Fall of the House of Usher, the big ones we associate. This is, I guess, a Edgar Allan Poe deep cut, in a sense. What about you, Dave?
It was certainly not one of the stories I was familiar with before seeing the film version of it. And certainly, I've corrected that since, as we'll get into in a bit. And, yeah, it's not, as far as the short story goes, it's not one of Poe's best by any stretch of the imagination, although it does offer a few interesting detours in terms of his work. And we'll probably get there in a little bit when we get and dive into this deeper. As for the film version, though, I guess one of the things we should probably lay out is a bit of the context for what is this movie and why did we jump to this one? And also, namely, who the heck is Roger Corman? And I'm sure a good chunk of our listeners are probably sitting there saying, we know who Roger Corman is. Don't waste our time. Bear with us. We'll make it worth your while.
You've never heard it explained like this before.
Yeah. So, yes, Roger Corman. For those of you who grew up in, say, the 90s and 2000s like myself and Andrew did, you're probably have a very specific image of Roger Corman. What do you think that's fair to say, Andrew?
I think that's fair. I mean, he was a very prolific director, and probably even more prolific as a producer and sort of almost like the mentor to an up-and-coming wave of American filmmakers. In previous episodes, we've talked about his somewhat tenuous connections with Samuel Fuller, certainly his connections with Paul Bartel. Basically, anybody that wasn't working in a major studio that wanted to get it done, sooner or later, they seemed to run into Roger Corman, because he was the gold standard of non-studio, truly independent American cinema in his day.
Yeah, but I would say probably by the time, if you're in the 90s and you were like me and, you know, you would eat up as many issues of Fangoria or Sci-Fi Invasion or Starlog or whatever else you get. Roger Corman, despite all of what Andrew has just said being true, was probably best known as the producer of Grade Z schlock, for the most part.
And now that I'm thinking about it, I totally didn't actually answer your question. In hindsight, yeah, we reflect on him almost like the way that we talk about William Castle, as sort of like the king of the creature features. You know, a Roger Corman film is made on a shoestring budget to appeal to teenagers, and usually has some kind of over-the-top gimmick that helps sell it along. Now, that isn't necessarily true of all of his films, but certainly in the cultural imaginary, I think that's sort of the idea we have of him.
Sort of, yeah, and I would think that's still the idealized version with him, of him, because eventually you get to the point where he's producing stuff like, what was it, like Black Scorpion, like straight to Sci-Fi Channel, really, you know, incompetent type stuff, and probably the most notorious film of the sort of period we're talking about is the one that never saw release, which is Roger Corman's, the Roger Corman produced Fantastic Four film, which I will say it is easy to be able to find a copy of that these days, assuming you're not looking for an official copy, because that doesn't exist.
By default, it has to be better than the most recent Fantastic Four film, simply by virtue of the fact that the most recent one exists at all. So, yeah, Corman, you know, and despite, like, linking him very closely to schlocky horror, I mean, like, if you look at his credits, he sort of had a hand on everything. And it's sort of like, well, if there's a way to make money, or if we can find a way to get audiences to go see it, it's like, well, yeah, we'll try whatever works until we can get a return on investment.
And the thing about Corman is, it's kind of fascinating about him, is that, yeah, so many filmmakers were basically went through what is more or less the Corman school, as it were, of, you know, just get to work on something and learn as you do it. So you end up with people like Francis Ford Coppola, who worked under Corman. You had Joe Dante, who edited trailers for Roger Corman throughout the 70s. Even James Cameron, notoriously, worked doing special effects on a number of Corman productions throughout the late 70s, early 80s, before getting hired to direct Piranha 2 after its previous filmmaker had been fired. So, you know, Corman, you know, kind of has an interesting cultural position in that way, where so much, even though his own personal influence as a filmmaker may be somewhat limited in this day and age, so many of his disciples have gone on and had significant influence. So much to the point where Corman, again, you watch films like, guess what? Oscar winner, Silence of the Lambs, and guess who's in the cast of that movie?
Ah, yes. Boy, right alongside Robin Hitchcock. But yeah, the term that I use for cats like Roger Corman, I call him a cousin Marvin. Because in Back to the Future, when Marty's playing Johnny B. Goode, and the guy runs, and he grabs the phone and calls Chuck Berry, and announces, "It's your cousin, Marvin Berry. You know that new sound you've been looking for?" Roger Corman's kind of like that, because, like, you know, he's not Jonathan Demme, but Jonathan Demme probably wouldn't have made Silence of the Lambs when he did, or at all, had it not been for Roger Corman. So he's the guy handing somebody the phone call that gives them their big break.
Absolutely. But prior to that, you know, Corman himself was a filmmaker. And the thing about Roger Corman is, I think because so much of us, so much of his later output as producer and more or less studio head, even if we have to put studio in sort of quotes at times, is the fact that, you know, he did start off in filmmaking, and honestly, had actually a rather respectable body of work before he segued into being predominantly a producer and entrepreneur, as it were, within the film industry. And, you know, that leads us to his relationship with a little company called AIP. And I think, Andrew, we've discussed AIP at least in part on this show before. But for those who, just as a quick reminder, AIP was basically one of the independent, close to Poverty Row studios of Hollywood, start around the late 50s and into the 1960s, and continuing to exist throughout the 1970s.
And that was Samuel Arkoff, right?
Samuel Arkoff, and also, oh, who was his producing partner on that one? I apologize for not having written this down beforehand here, folks.
I apologize for asking.
Yes, but Arkoff was a part of that, and they were pretty much, Arkoff and, oh, yeah, no, it's Arkoff, strictly as well. But anyways, yeah, with Arkoff's production company, the basic thing was they were sort of a low-level company that produced programmers and B-movies, mainly intended for places like the drive-in or double features or grindhouse cinemas. So they were just pretty much cranking stuff out to, you know, they weren't releasing what was considered the top-tier product that studios would.
Yeah, they don't care about winning critics awards. They just care about getting people in the theater for that first 2 weeks and making some money off the project. So, again, like, AIP, that's our excuse towards the more gimmicky kind of things, or, like, horror films ripped from today's headlines. But Corman, something happens to him in, I guess, the early 1960s that kind of changes the way that we look at him. And I guess it would be interesting to track the discourse of how people received this this series of films versus how we look back on it now. But that kind of brings us to Premature Burial.
Yeah, so Premature Burial is the third film in what's basically referred to as the Poe cycle. Because starting in, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, 1960, Roger Corman, you know, ends up writing or directing a film for AIP called House of Usher, based on the story Fall of the House of Usher by Edgar Allan Poe. And it's a quickly produced film, made on a very tight budget, done in color, starring Vincent Price, who had was at this point sort of segueing into what we now consider sort of the classic Price, who is, you know, the master of the macabre, you know, star of horror films, after a fairly long career as mostly a supporting character actor. And that film ends up making a bucket load of money and begins would turn out to be a long-running relationship with AIP and Roger Corman that would result in what was eight films that are considered the Poe cycle, the third of which is Premature Burial. The thing that's fascinating to note, though, about this one is it didn't start off as an AIP production. Mainly, Corman, the way in which their relationship worked was basically AIP would fund Corman, and Corman, through his own, you know, offices, would end up producing these films, AIP would distribute, and the profits were supposed to be split. Some sort of accounting dispute arose after their second collaboration together, and Corman decided, guess what, I'm just going to go off and do this on my own, and finds a willing partner in this, in a little company called Cinema Pathé, basically who specialized in developing film stock for various studios, most notably AIP amongst them. And this ends up being kind of interesting because Pathé wants to get into distribution at this point, and they think, well, hey, you know, these are quickly produced movies. Roger Corman's looking for somebody to invest because he's not working with AIP. So, you know what? We can go ahead and, you know, we'll finance his films because that seems like a fairly safe bet, wouldn't it?
Plus, I mean, at that point in time, they can already point to it and say, well, Roger, you know, we know he knows what he's doing. He doesn't go over budget. He doesn't go over schedule. He can crank him out. And he's a guy that, at least for what he's making, he knows what he's doing. So, yeah, let's get some skin in the game on this cat. What could go wrong?
I love how that seems to be our go-to question often whenever we're talking about these films.
It's only because we're on a remarkable run of problematic productions lately.
True. Well, I maybe problematic's a bit difficult, a bit much for this one. But Corman goes off and, you know, he starts assembling, you know, his cast and crew for this movie. Now, you have individuals like Floyd Crosby, his cinematographer, who worked with him on the previous Poe pictures and who, you know, had run afoul of with the House of Un-American Activities Committee back in the 1950s. He ends up, you know, writers Charles Beaumont, who was very notable for to many sci-fi and fantasy nerds as somebody who wrote for both The Twilight Zone and also, you know, producing a ton of short science fiction and horror stories on his own, along with Ray Russell, who would later go on to co-write probably a much more significant Corman film, usually subtitled The Man with the X-Ray Eyes. There, but we'll get to that one day. But the key thing is, because he wasn't working with AIP, there was a very key component from the first two Poe movies that Corman couldn't bring with him, namely Vincent Price.
Yes, because so, last I checked, by that point in time, you can't legally own another person, even if you're a studio. But you can also restrict their activity dramatically.
Certainly at this point in time, because, you know, Price was under contract with AIP and, you know, they weren't going to lend him out to a guy who was going into competition with them. So what ends up happening is Corman ends up securing Ray Milland, an actor who, you know, I think is very much, you know, was well respected and at one point was actually a reasonable leading man in Hollywood, probably most famous for The Long Weekend.
The Lost Weekend.
Sorry.
If anyone's ever made jokes about bugs coming out of the walls, they're getting it from there. But yeah, so, I mean, Vincent Price, after the first two Poe films, like, he sort of kind of reestablishes himself as, like, the... I guess he brings a certain pedigree to what would otherwise be pulpy horror. But, I mean, in that sense, Ray Milland already had a pretty strong degree of pedigree. And even though he, some would say that his best days were behind him in 1962, he is at least established enough and legitimate enough that even though they can't have Vincent Price, they can go for the same idea. You have the anchor for the film. And this film in particular really is kind of structured as, like, it's structured around one character and one character's performance, by and large. So in that respect, I mean, it's a natural transition. You swap out one for the other.
Yeah, and I mean, certainly Milland, you know, this was of benefit to him because in the preceding 4 years, he didn't really have any leading roles. He'd become, again, a very, you know, well-established supporting cast member in, you know, relatively big mainstream films. But, you know, he certainly, as you noted, Andrew, wasn't at the top of his game. He certainly wasn't getting the kind of parts he was getting, you know, a decade earlier at this point. So for him, this is kind of a big deal in terms of, okay, I get to be headlining a film again. Sure, it's for AIP, but that's better than nothing. So you got Milland on board, and they fill out a cast that includes Hazel Court, Richard Nye, Heather Angel, Alan Napier, and again, as we noted last week, TV's Alfred from TV's Batman. And of course, Roger Corman's staple, Dick Miller, as Mole, and John Derricks. Dierks, I'm not entirely sure you pronounce that last name.
Dierks,
what would you say, Andrew? Dierks, okay. But as, as Mr. Sweeney. And you're kind of off to the races, and sure enough, day one of filming. This is a movie ready to go. And what do you think would be of note? What would you think could possibly happen on a first day that would be super notable on a production like this, Andrew?
Oh, you know, everybody shows up on time, they all go over what they're doing, shake hands, get to know one another, maybe an icebreaker game. You know, they go around the circle and, my name is Ray Milland, and I brought raspberries.
Yeah, no, exactly. But wouldn't you know it, one little odd detail happens that it ends up being rather significant, which is Samuel Arkoff ends up returning back up onto the set to basically, you know, sort of start shake hands with Corman. And even though he had nothing to do with this film, ended up, you know, pretty much, you know, coming there to congratulate him and, you know, they, you know, it's like, it's good they got this up and running. It's nice to that everything's going well. And as Corman likes to tell the tale, it's like, well, it was very nice of them to come and show up and, you know, congratulate me and be good sports about this, even though we had disagreements. And then they dropped the bomb on him that he's still technically working for AIP because it turns out that they pretty much strong-armed Pathé into selling their portion of the film to them by pretty much telling him, well, if you go up against us, we're pretty much going to take our business of developing film at your company somewhere else. And yeah, Pathé saw that, saw the writing on the wall and decided, okay, we're going to do that. But apparently, despite that, that didn't really end up hurting the production in any way, shape, or form. It really ultimately just sort of ended up, you know, making some very key changes and some of the creative talent involved than would have otherwise been the case.
Yeah, it seems like the lasting impact of this weird shell game of ownership and distribution from the hop is just that it prevents Vincent Price from being in this movie. But I think aside from that, and I mean, certainly compared to the other Poe films, like, this seems like a film that, I mean, I've never talked to Roger Corman about, but it seems like this probably came out pretty close to what he intended in the first place.
Yeah, there's no indication that I've seen that this was somehow the Arkoff and James H. Nicholson. That's Arkoff's partner. I apologize for not being able to remember his name earlier, folks. There's nothing to indicate that there was any creative disagreements between them on this film. I mean, the film basically turned out the way it was always going to, other than the fact that probably if it had started as an AIP production from day one, there was probably a better than average chance Vincent Price would have been in the lead role here. I mean, certainly every the five films that they would make afterwards as part of the post cycle all end up starring Price afterwards. So that kind of makes this film a little bit of the odd one out in a way when it comes to this overall cycle of movies. And, you know, so on that level, you know, it's not really a troubled production, just so much as at least the production insight gives us an understanding as to why this one seems to be the outlier in an otherwise relatively consistent series.
Well, and if I may, David, I think part of why Poe is so beloved by filmmakers and still remembered so well is that he's a very efficient and economical writer for the most part. Like, he creates a lot of atmosphere, but most of his stories hinge around one simple idea, or, like, one horrific image, or a particular gimmick. And, I mean, like, certainly the later films like Mask of the Red Death in particular, you know, that's as straightforward as they come, and the film that follows is equally straightforward. It just has some very beautiful set design as well. Whereas Premature Burial, it's almost Chimes at Midnight, in a sense, where it's an adaptation, but it's also a reworking of the source material. Because if you read the short story that this is based on, it doesn't quite correspond to the film here. Instead, it's this weird quasi-anthology narrative about famous instances of people who have been buried alive and how the narrator managed to overcome that. And what this film is instead is it sort of selects and reworks all those different storytelling elements, gets rid of the frame narrative, and instead we have a more, I guess, a more Poe-esque, straightforward story about a man deeply tormented by his phobia of being buried alive.
Well, that's the thing. There's an interesting thing to note about the original Poe story itself. It's that compared to most of his works, and I think very much the popular perception of Poe himself, is that it's actually rather optimistic compared to, you know, things such as the Cask of
Amontillado.
Amontillado, thank you. And the or, you know, even The Raven, or many, or the Black Cat. You know, all these wonderful stories, but they're very dour and bleak, and I mean, probably the Telltale Heart being the most notable amongst those. In the case of this short story, it's actually rather mild because, yeah, after the sort of three or four case studies that the narrator of the story gives to sort of provide a context of, yes, premature burial is a thing, and it's something we should, you know, everybody was legitimately terrified, which probably is of more important, I think, to audiences in the, you know, nearly 200 years since its publication than it was for readers at the time, who probably understood fairly well that, yeah, this is a thing that happens.
Give Poe some credit. He was forward-thinking and future-inclusive.
Yeah, but in the case of this short story, it ultimately comes down to a guy who has catalepsy, is, and although it appears to be psychosomatic in nature, as we'll end up discovering, who, you know, is fearful about the possibility of being buried alive and being misunderstood, takes all sorts of precautions in terms of what, you know, where he's going to be buried, what has to happen, you know, what he'll be surrounded by, to try and prevent it if that should be the case. And one night wakes up in the berth of a boat, completely forgets who he is, freaks out, thinking he's been buried alive and he can't get out, only to gradually regain a sense of the fact that, no, you're perfectly fine. And lo and behold, through this rather mundane instance in, you know, of terror, he ends up overcoming both his catalepsy and his fear of being buried alive, which is on one hand kind of dull and kind of, you know, unexciting.
It's nowhere near as bonkers as the climax of this film, but it's also tonally the complete opposite.
Well, absolutely. And it's sort of like, okay, I mean, you had a good thing going there for the most part, Poe, but you didn't really stick the landing on this one. But yeah.
So he probably, out of frustration, just spent the rest of his career writing real downers.
Yeah, but in this instance, so it's interesting that way, and yeah, you're right. The screenplay that is put together for this film by Beaumont and Russell really does try to hew closer to at least the popular perception of what Poe's work is like by bringing a bit more of the gothic overtones and certainly some of the more morbid details of it.
Well,
and...
yeah, because Poe is also like Corman in that sense, where usually they sort of proceed from that one central idea, and most of the film is just exploring like that one gimmick or that one concept. But there's also, you know, the idea that the popular conception of Poe is not necessarily indicative of everything that he ever did. I mean, like, people have made the argument that Murders in the Rue Morgue, for instance, was the first detective narrative. But we remember Poe first and foremost as that, you know, ornate and atmospheric author of the macabre. The same way that we remember Corman as, you know, the king of the drive-in. And it's just interesting how you phrase that, where they're adapting Poe's story based on the idea of what Poe's work is like rather than the actual source text itself. And I find that very interesting, especially because it's happening in the 1960s, long before, you know, concepts of media theory really take root in popular discourse, which assumes that they ever did. So, what at heart, though, is the premature burial about?
So, the film version of The Premature Burial stars Ray Milland as Guy Carroll, a medical doctor/researcher who, as the film opens, is participating in an excavation alongside Dr. Galt, played by Alan Napier, and two grave robbers, Mole and Mr. Sweeney, played by Miller and Dierks, however you want to pronounce it, I'm sorry.
Mr. D.
Who are almost like very loosely based on like Burke and Hare, as you sort of see them here. And lo and behold, as they dig into this relatively fresh grave, they open up and discover a body that is clearly clawing at the top of the coffin, having been buried alive. What we soon discover is that this incident, after months later, has led Guy Carroll to more or less become a recluse in his, you know, very sort of gothic family manor, which has its own vault down below, where he lives with his sister, who is played by
Heather
goodness,
Angel.
Why? Oh, sorry. Yeah, Heather Angel. Sorry, thank you. And the character's name is Kate Carroll, despite the fact that I wrote it down as Jate Carroll in our notes for some baffling reason.
I put her down as Steve Carroll, but go on.
Yeah. All right. But anyways, this you know, sort of seclusion is interrupted, however, by Emily Galt, Dr. Galt's daughter, played by Hazel Court, who is deeply in love with Guy and can't understand why he doesn't want to see her and what's going on. And as he quickly reveals, he takes her down into the family tomb where his ancestors are buried and explains his history where, you know, as was true, you know, he remembered years ago as a child, he was convinced his father was buried alive in the tomb and that he heard it at night. And yet, you know, his father had suffered from catalepsy. This has, you know, led to this sort of ongoing fear of this, which, you know, discovering a body, you know, clawing at the top of its coffin months earlier has pretty much pushed to the forefront. He's having trouble sleeping, is convinced that he himself may suffer from catalepsy and will one day be buried alive, and figures he's not going to put someone he loves through all this sort of torment just to go
now,
through all this.
Catalepsy itself, do you know if that's a real disease? I know there are similar conditions that are like what the film argues it to be. Historical trivia, do you know if that was actually ever a thing?
There is a catalepsy, I think. I'm not sure if it's used in modern medical parlance, but it certainly seemed to be a general description for a series of characteristics where the body went rigid and seemed to give the impression of death. So it does seem
like
to have
locked in syndrome. And I mean, that as a trope has been used in, it's been used in various other places. Stephen King has a story about a guy who suffers that on a golf course. There's an episode of Crossing Jordan where it happens to Ron Silver. And that's the only episode of Crossing Jordan I've ever seen. But, like, there are real-world infirmities that cause sort of a form of paralysis that genuinely looks like a person has died. But, yeah, so part of the question in this film, though, is does Guy suffer for this from this, or does his, like, you know, his incredibly intense fear of that, is that more likely to create a psychosomatic response where he ends up displaying those symptoms? Either way, though, he's convinced that he has it, and he's also absolutely, adamantly convinced that he is going to get buried alive.
Absolutely. But despite his protesting, Emily wins out, convincing him that, no, you know, I am willing to take the risk. Doesn't matter. I love you. We'll be married. And, you know, Guy pretty much says, okay. Although his sister Kate doesn't seem to be nearly as happy with this, giving more or less a few passive-aggressive comments about how she's, you know, thinks this isn't going to end well for anybody. Dun-dun-dun. At any rate, they get married, and, you know, it seems like everything's going to be happy. They're going to take off, you know, to Italy for a while and on their honeymoon. But lo and behold, you know, suddenly things such as particular music starts triggering, you know, outburst in Guy where he starts suddenly remembering that night at the grave or fears of being buried alive. And, you know, he starts freaking out.
To everybody around Guy's credit, though, it does not take much for Guy to suddenly be triggered by his phobia of premature burial. And the second that that happens, he ends up having the most over-the-top emotional reaction to it imaginable. So I can't imagine it was a lot of fun to marry this guy.
Yeah. And like, so we'll dive into more about that and particularly Ray Milland's performance in a little bit. But yes, this is what ends up being the case. Here he starts freaking out. You know, at one point his dog seems to have been struck by lightning, which, having accepted it was going to die, mere moments later, it gets up alive and he was concerned, I was going to bury it alive.
This was my favorite moment in the entire film. But I think we'll get into a bit more of why this film has the effect it does. Sorry, I'll stop interrupting.
No, that's why. I figured you were going to when I brought that one up.
We'll come back to the dog. So circumstances all keep coming together, and it seems despite his best efforts to try to be happy on his wedding day, Guy just can't shake this idea that his catalepsy will cause him to be mistakenly buried alive. So, like anybody, though, instead of wringing his hands over it, he decides to get to work and build himself a fail-safe crypt with all his elaborate trappings. So just in case it ever happens, he gives himself about, like, 12 different fail-safe mechanisms that he can get out.
And let me put it to you this way, because it is technically a scene from the book, or from the short story. Because in the short story, it's like, okay, I set it up so I had a trick coffin, but I could magically open, and my hand would be tied to this bell where if I started moving it, it would cause the bell to open. And there was a lever which, you know, I could open up the crypt from the inside if I needed to, and had a few foodstuffs should any of this fail.
Well, that's the extent of it. It's a Rube Goldberg mechanism that's designed to solve a problem that doesn't really exist.
Well, it's the thing. I mean, in the short story, it's like, okay, this is clearly the actions of a paranoid individual and with deep-seated phobias. But it kind of, you know, it still plays as peering into his psychosis. The film decides to step this up, like, by about times five. And ends up being my favorite scene in the movie, where Ray Milland takes Emily and his cohort, Miles Archer, the other doctor who Emily at one point was romantically interested in as well, and show them around in almost smug enjoyment at, you know, it's like, hey, here's my tricked out crypt. See, I got this totally awesome, you know, tricked out coffin. I can open the roof with this lever. I can open the doors with this lever. I can blow down the
door with this stack of dynamite.
Dynamite. And should everything ultimately fail, I got a cup of poison on, you know, in the sort of ornate little section of the crypt that I will drink if it really comes down.
Yeah, like, with just enough dry ice in there to make it smoke on camera. Ray Milland presents MTV Crypts.
My favorite detail, though, and it's the best gag that I swear had to have been intentional, is right at the start, when he opens up the lift of the coffin before showing that it is a trick coffin, you see that he has installed tools in the top of the thing. Obviously, out of the fear that if this doesn't work, you know, he can dig his way out of wherever he is. What's great is, even though that's obviously the case, it's the one thing he never explains.
Exactly.
It's just, it's the most blatant one. It's like, no, that's not the one. I really want to show you the dynamite.
It's like in pro wrestling. I mean, pro wrestling really follows the logic of Chekhov's gun. But there have been certain matches where, like, a guy will unfasten the turnbuckle pad and expose the steel underneath. So you think it's going to play into it. And then they just have a straight-ahead match, and it ends normally, and the turnbuckle never comes into play. And there's that feeling with the audience of being completely hoodwinked, where the one thing we were focused on is the one thing that nobody talks about.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so again, kudos to that scene alone. But basically, yeah, his paranoia continues to develop despite the best efforts of Emily and Miles to sort of intervene. Certainly, Miles actually ends up moving in to utilize some space on Carol's property, where he's experimenting with a battery for medical science, mostly shocking frog legs, which, yes, is something that actually was done by the medical community in the mid-1800s. So good on you, Corman and Company, for getting some details right.
Yes, it's scientifically sound. I bet Neil deGrasse Tyson tweeted favorably about this one. But then the unthinkable happens. One night, going down into the family crypt to verify whether or not there's anybody in the house, or whether or not Guy's father actually was buried alive, they start investigating, and they open up his crypt, and a skeleton falls on Guy. And
well, you jumped.
Know it, he dies from fright. Or does he?
Well, you jumped ahead a little bit, because eventually, you know, prior to this, Emily convinces him, basically gives him the ultimatum of either you destroy your tricked-out crypt, which had to have cost a pretty penny, or I'm ultimately just going to leave you because I can't live like this. And he chooses her, destroys the crypt, and on a big, you know, get-together dinner with her father and Miles and Kate, his sister. Yeah, the whole incident where they finally think he's going to face his fears by going down into the crypt and is going to happen. And yeah, he dies from, seemingly dies from fright, despite, you know, the efforts of Miles to shock him with electricity into living, amongst other things. And having taken, you know, Emily's promise that he wasn't, you know, Emily promised him earlier in the film, we're not going to put you in the family crypt. So what ends up happening? They're going to bury him in the ground over in the graveyard. With a specially tricked out coffin with a window for him to look out, apparently, or for people to look in on his face, as they put in the ground. But wouldn't you know, this entire time, we can hear Guy's thoughts as he, because he is, yes, in a cataleptic state. And ultimately, yes, his fears come true. He is buried alive.
What are the odds of that happening?
But does the film end there, Andrew?
No, it doesn't, because Chekhov's grave robbers from earlier in the film, they dig up Guy, who by that point, through his ordeal, has come back to life, has regained all of his motor control and none of his sanity. He proceeds to brutally murder them and then discover that they were actually acting under the orders of Kate's father, TV's Alfred. He proceeds to murder him as well, and then he storms through the castle, or the manor, and then proceeds to grab his wife and point out that she allowed him to be buried, so now she must be punished with the rest. He throws her into a grave, begins burying her. Miles intervenes, right? Problem solved. Until he is easily overpowered by a frenzied old man, and as he's about to deliver the killing blow with his shovel, from literally off-screen, his sister appears, shoots him in the back, and then Guy is dead. But Miles is too late to save Kate, who is also dead. That's a real downer, right? It's a beautiful young woman cut down in the prime of her life.
But it turns out she was planning to kill, you know, try and kill Guy the entire time. So technically, it's a just comeuppance in this sense, because she just wanted the money and the title that comes with him.
Much like Hamlet, the sister realizes that she finally decided to act, but only after it was too late. So it ends with Miles and the sister sitting mournfully in a graveyard, and it pans over two dead bodies and a tombstone that reads, "Rest in Peace."
The end.
I feel God, like we could have fun. Summarized this film a lot more simply, but then we would have taken out half the fun. So, basically, the whole time I was watching this film, I was thinking, there were a number of consistent thoughts. One, it's not clear how old Guy is supposed to be, but I can almost guarantee that his character is younger than either Ray Milland or Vincent Price would have been at this point in time.
Yeah, I mean, because the way in which the role is written, you get the feeling that Guy is somebody who should be, like, in his 20s at most. You know, he's somebody who's researching, you know, stuff. He has a family, you know, crypt, and, you know, there's this concern about the idea that I can't marry you because, you know, if I marry you, there's a chance I may have this cataleptic instance and die or be buried alive. And the thing about it is, on one hand, if it was a young guy having that would strike you as very paranoid. When it's 50-plus-year-old Ray Milland,
yeah,
and you're considering that this is in the 1800s, it's like, yeah, there's probably a good chance he'll probably be dead within about 5 or 10 years.
Exactly. I mean, catalepsy aside, you can just say, no, you shouldn't marry me because I'm probably going to kick it next week.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like, I'm reasonably sure his casting is too old for the role that he's playing here. And what I find hilarious is then, because of this, you get things like they have to cast around him for the age thing to make sense. So suddenly he has a sister who, again, I'm not saying, you know, she should be married, but you would consider within the cultural context of America at that point in time, odds are she probably would have married somebody by that point in time. And they cast Alan Napier to play his father. And it's like, they basically said, it's like, who's the one guy who Ray Milland might reasonably look younger compared to in this film? And that's the basis, because he keeps treating him like he's looking down on him. It's like, dude, you're contemporaries. You're not really,
exactly. Like, it's probably part of the same high school graduating cohort, you know? It's, I mean, it's a little silly. That's not necessarily a fault of the film, the film's narrative. But, I mean, in trying to tell the story that they have with the resources they do, they're forced to make a bunch of odd little shoehorns like that. But I think the other thing is that, okay, especially as the film progresses, based off your plot description, it's clear to see that this film eventually gets pretty ludicrous and over the top. It begins steeped in a very kind of, familiar gothic mode, and sort of that melodrama where everything's a little exaggerated or hyper-stylized. Especially the opening shots of the manor itself and the heavy use of the color red. Like, it's not the slickest film ever, but there's a certain unity of the design. It all fits within that sort of eerie Poe vibe that they're trying to do. They pulled that off well. But the issue is that I feel like this is a film that needs to either commit to sort of everything is grounded except the one character that becomes gradually unhinged, or it just needs to be flat out ridiculous and over the top and campy and at least be fun that way. And it's, I don't know if I can describe it as it affects me, but I feel like Ray Milland's performance is, from the outset, is way too over the top, that we don't really get that slide into madness as much as he's still doing the same things, only he's murdering people now. It's just the fact that everything in that first half hour happens and just so happens to resonate with his oddly specific fear of being buried alive, and yet, like, everything in the film, you know, corroborates that fear, where, that the song that his bride is playing on the piano, that, is it ever explained what's up with that?
Yeah, it's because it's the one that the gravediggers were whistling at the start of the film.
Yes. She's playing piano. You know, it's the wedding day. He just married a woman 30 years his junior, and she starts playing that melody on the piano, and he immediately runs over and just, like, angrily, "Stop playing the piano now!" And, like, I just lost it right then, because no one should ever sound so angry telling someone to stop playing piano. But then the dog scene happens, and it's just like, it's especially the problem is that the Poe aesthetic filtered through Corman's style and Milland's performance, it can't be anything other than over the top and ridiculous. Like, they find the dog, and the sister explains, oh, he was probably struck by lightning, as if that's a thing that happens every day. Like, oh, okay, let's get a shovel. And then the dog barks, and then the music swells, and we get that close-up of Ray Milland's face as he, like, slowly crumbles under the realization of, I nearly buried my dog alive, and, like, grabs his temples and wails. It's like, there is no joy for Guy, because based off what we've seen, he spends every single waking moment absolutely consumed and miserable with the fear that he might get buried before he's dead.
See, the thing is I agree with you, but I'm coming at it from almost the alternate perspective, because the thing about Ray Milland is that as an actor, he is, for the most part, very... Number one, he doesn't fit a period film quite as easily. Like, there's something that feels very contemporary about him as a performer in a way that, you know, Price can sort of slide in anywhere. Milland, I don't think quite, you know, ever feels like he's part of a period per se. But I think the other problem is that, you know, he's too put together most of the other time, that whenever he goes into his hysterics, it feels like somebody just flipped a switch. Without anything, like, there's nothing consistent about the nature of his mental status, as it were. There's no sense. I mean, he's either completely stable or completely unstable, and there is no middle ground. And someone like Price is able to sort of play the register and go up and down and go with the flow of things in a way that feels, you know, it feels right and it feels like it flows one another. I mean, yeah, certainly Price is more theatrical in his performing style, I think, than Milland typically is.
But I think also given his collaborations previous and the ones that would come later, like, Vincent Price has a very unique screen presence and performance style as well. And I think it naturally works with certainly like the Poe vein of storytelling a lot more than Ray Milland. But like, I think it's also just because the weirdness of Guy's phobia of being buried alive. Like, there's even that scene where Emily ends up asking Miles for advice on, like, how best to manage her husband. And his advice is basically, okay, well, we don't want to upset him, because if he's, and basically lays out that he thinks he might have a psychosomatic episode, because he genuinely believes himself to be cataleptic. And his advice is, don't mention anything involving death or burials. And it's like... Okay, so basically, that's like, oh, I suffer from depression. How do we deal with that? Okay, don't ever mention anything sad around him. It's just like, okay, this is an absurd film. It's difficult to take seriously despite the best efforts. But, like, I feel the film missed a trick by... Maybe it's just because Ray Milland adds the one leading man here that kind of isn't supposed to be there, where it's just, I feel like Price could hit those notes a bit better, or at least commit, because I feel like in spite of the thinness of the material, because even though we describe the film, like, in depth, I mean, I think we're being a little generous, like, this is firmly within, like, Corman camp, where the script isn't being scrutinized over, it's not supposed to win awards or any of that stuff, just supposed to be reasonably competent. But, like, Milland, I feel like he's trying too hard to, like, use his performance to salvage and elevate this material, whereas everybody else has a much better understanding of what this film is. And as a result, like, there is this weird discordancy where Milland seems to be taking everything stone seriously, and everybody else is just... Not saying that they're winking at the audience, but there's a bit more... I don't know. It feels a bit more synchronized with the rest of the cast.
Well, it's ultimately, everything is more theatrical in a way. Like, I mean, they realize they're playing in high gothic melodrama, whereas Milan is very much, it's not that he's doing the Lost Weekend in a Corman movie, but he's trying very hard to, you know, I'm going to play this a little more real. Or at least try to, even though the script as it exists isn't really asking for that type of performance here. I mean, Carmen is not giving a nuanced approach to psychology. I mean, this is a script that has moments where, you know, they start talking about, you know, one day maybe man will be able to understand the working of the mind and
this isn't a film that's subtle with regards to anything.
No, exactly. And, you know, it has this sort of classic moment at the end where the entire mystery is explained by one character through, you know, 2-minute exposition monologue saying she was in on it the whole time. You know, that's the kind of realm we're in. And Milland doesn't quite fit there. But I think it's very telling when you get, I think, to a year later and he is appearing in Roger Corman's at that point, it's a much better fit where everybody seems to be on the same page.
Agreed.
And it certainly helps.
Performance in that film, like, it works with the film, and I think he has a better sense of, like, the Corman style as well. But we actually almost picked that one this week, and in hindsight, I'm kind of wishing that we did. But, I mean, then I wouldn't have had the dog scene to look fondly upon for the rest of my life.
We will get to the Man with the X-Ray Eyes one of these days. I mean, it really is... that's one of the great Corman films, and one of the ones where there is really meat on the bone to take apart.
But it's also a modern film, and then this one is both an adaptation of a very, very sort of culturally encoded and culturally understood author, and it's also, like, I don't think they ever list what year it's supposed to be, but it is a period piece.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's very much a period piece, and yeah, it's very much made in a very, it's a very stylized version of the period, as we would see in all the Poe films. And when I call, you know, these movies as my catnip, I'm not lying, because I am a sucker for the Poe films, and I'm a sucker for this sort of, you know, very stylized, sort of, the period style that these movies all utilize. I mean, you get things such as here, like one of the things, and I, again, it's a small detail, but you'd mentioned the use of the color red earlier, Andrew, and things like the use of the color red, the red candles that recur throughout this entire film, and the way in which they really vibrantly stand out in here is just, you know, it is really visually striking, interesting. I love the design of these sets. I love the way in which everything is filmed by Floyd Crosby, where it's got this sort of, I mean, it's, everything's clearly filmed on a stage, but it's a beautiful looking stage that they're shooting this on.
Yeah, and they integrate the shots well enough that it makes it seem like a continuous space. And that's not always an easy thing to do. And, I mean, that's sort of, within Corman, like, that's one of his strengths, I think, that, you know, there's the tendency to dismiss his films as very superficial, but, like, when you look, there's stuff going on that, you know, more capable filmmakers were doing, or just things that, like, certainly other B-movie directors, whether fairly or unfairly, they certainly were not. And, like, this film has a bunch of dialogic callbacks to other Poe stories. Like when they go down to the wine cellar and they're trying to pick a bottle, and he asks, oh, do you have any of that Amontillado? Or, like, even the idea that Richard Ney's character is named Miles Archer. That's Sam Spade's partner in The Maltese Falcon. So it's just, like, it doesn't add up to anything, but it shows that, hey, these are people that understand the material they're working with, and they understand culture in a larger sense. Like, they didn't just show up and say, eh, we'll slap whatever we can. There's all these little weird details that really are kind of Corman's signature.
Well, it's the thing, and ultimately the thing that makes this film, whatever its weaknesses, and it's certainly, I would say, one of the weaker entries in the Poe cycle, is it's still tons of fun. Like, I mean, yeah, you'll see the twist coming a mile away. Yeah, everything is a little campy and a little goofy, but that's kind of the charm of these movies. Like, I mean, it's very much a, you know, hyper-stylized horror film that's playing on all the sort of classic images and tropes, but it does it, you know, it commits to it, and it does it well for the most part. And, you know, this is the kind of gateway horror film I think that's great for, particularly if you're having a Halloween party, or you're, you know, you've got younger kids who want, you know, I want to see something scary. And of course, they're not actually really ready for anything terribly scary. You know, the Poe films kind of have this nice balance where they're creepy and they can be scary in scare quotes for younger generations, but it's not going to be, you know, Tobe Hooper's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where you traumatize a child for life by allowing them to watch it. This one, it's more, you know, hopefully, odds are they'll probably have a fun time. Although maybe I'd start with The Raven, the comedy one, and go from there.
Well, I think another strength, though, is, again, something that unites Poe and Corman, is that there is a very strong sense of atmosphere to these works. Like, yeah. Again, like, this isn't a scary film necessarily, but it is an eerie one. And especially, like, the use of music. Ronald Stein did the music on this one. And Floyd Crosby's photography and the set design. Like, it does capture sort of, like, that, you know, a very coherent and unified sense of atmosphere that is maintained throughout the film. I think maybe why this one doesn't work as well, two things. Well, I mean, two very, very clearly linked things. It's the climax of this film doesn't really, it's not like there's a really thrilling set piece that sort of caps this one off. Like, we don't have, you know, the figure of death walking into a castle and laying ruin to everything around. We don't have Usher's house falling apart and, you know, dead bodies coming out of the ground or anything like that. Instead, we just, you know, the climax is Ray Milland trying to bury a struggling woman while everybody races to stop him. And similarly, like, that weird reversal that happens at the ending, I think it really kind of more stumps the viewer than necessarily, like, has them feeling shocked or surprised. Because again, like, by the time that guy goes off the deep end, and, like, especially, it's not necessarily graphic, the way it's shot, but, like, his murders are fairly brutal and fairly visceral for a film, like, that isn't showing on-screen decapitations or anything like that. Like, by the time he goes crazy, we've pretty firmly lost our sympathy for him, because, and the film itself presents him as the monster. Maybe not entirely by his own choice, but he basically emerges as the villain. And then we suddenly feel relieved that he gets shot in the back and sad that his wife doesn't make it. But then we get the reveal, and then it says, oh, so I guess everybody's dead, but that's okay, because they were bad people and they all got what they deserved. But there's no sense of closure or relief. Whereas horror, it tends to either resolve everything neatly and, like, the threat is contained, or we realize the threat is greater than the heroes we're cheering on to fight it. And neither of those really happen by the end of this film.
I think the major thing is it feels like it's coming up toward a sort of EC comic style climax where, yeah, it's basically he comes back from the grave and gets revenge on everybody and walks away scot-free. The problem is the production code at that point in time wasn't going to let them get away with that. So you weren't going to have, and then guy murders everyone and goes off to his merry way, having overcome his fear of, you know, being buried alive and his psychosomatic catalepsy. Which would probably be the more logical ending of this movie, were it to go that road. And yet, you know, the ending works fine for me. I mean, I admit it's not the most exciting of the Poe films in terms of their climaxes. I think what's more of an issue for me is the fact that really the murder mystery and basically you get to the end and Kate has this spiel about how her brother would never have believed her had she brought all her suspicions about Emily and her father to him, about the fact that they were just after the money and they were just, you know, trying to do this, you know, to gain control of the estate and everything else. And it's like, okay, maybe if you squint at it, but there's enough indicators early on that maybe Guy should have, you know, taken advantage and really sort of thought this one through. Starting with the fact that he willingly participates in a grave robbery at the start of the film with her dad. Probably a good indicator that Guy might not be most on the up and up here. I'm just saying. And yes, I know this is something that medical communities actually did in the 1800s and earlier, but I mean, it's still creepy. So big indicator, number one. Number two, and again, this is where Milan's sort of miscasting as being too old for the role comes into play. Why is Emily interested in you? Again, not to be shallow, but again, you are somebody who's probably going to die in about 5 or 6 years based upon the death rates of that period. So,
well, maybe she has lingering issues about her father and, you know, he's age comparable.
I guess it's, I don't know. It's just, to me, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, I think Kate could have probably made a much better argument than doing nothing and just being snide to everybody.
Yeah. We're led to infer that, well, she ends up, like, full of woe because she has to shoot her brother in the back. But, like, she doesn't really comment on that. Because immediately I'm like, wait, so if the wife is evil, why did she shoot him? So, like, you can infer that she realizes Guy is too far gone and, like, realizes he's been driven mad, so she ends his suffering. But, like, of the people left alive, you know, we have Jane sitting on the grave who's just lost her brother, and, you know, she is clearly despondent and nothing works out well for her. And then we have Miles sitting there who's lost his best friend and the kind of sort of romantic interest, and, like, they hint towards, like, a much longer relationship between Emily and Miles. You know, and, like, eventually we realize that, oh, well, her bringing up all those feelings was just in service of her plan. So you lost your friend, and you got duped. You've lost your brother, and this is how we, you know, bring up the creds and say, that's all, folks. It just, it ends on such a bummer, you know? And I know that not every film needs a happy ending. I know that certainly most of the films we watch don't have happy endings. But, like, it kind of tempers the enjoyment of it, because there's no sense of closure or at least, you know, any kind of justice being done. And horror, I mean, even to this day, tends to operate on very moralistic kind of principles. Like, even the Friday the 13th films, I mean, a lot of it sort of hinges on the idea that, well, the teens that act out and get up to monkey shines, they're the ones that die, whereas the ones who remain chaste and sober are the ones who make it out alive.
Actually, I think Friday the 13th has at least a few films that really do definitely challenge that dynamic, but I'm not necessarily interested in giving him any more credit than I have to. But I would say that probably part of the thing is that this film ultimately is much more of, it's not really, it's a horror film in style than in story, because ultimately what it boils down to is we're watching a dude deal with his phobias for 80 minutes, and getting played off of them for most of that time so that they can murder him for his money. That's really sort of a stock, like how many, you know, classic Universal B films, you know, of the 30s and 40s had that basic premise where it's like, you know, all these creepy goings on all connect back to this, you know, Scooby-Doo mystery where, you know, you look behind the curtain and there was nothing supernatural or creepy going on at all. And that kind of feels this way, except that there isn't really a supernatural element. It's just, you're basically, everything's focused on this dude's psychology for that time. And so on that level, it's only scary in the sense that you get jump scares and hypothetically maybe terrified at the inner psychology. That's not really what this film's focused upon in any meaningful way. Which, you know, is certainly, I think, it, you know, it's different from, say, something like Jekyll and Hyde, which is very much, you know, in the best renditions of that, focused on the inner psychosis there. And, yeah, no. Yeah, I'm sure I was going somewhere with that, but, yeah, I just sort of stumbled about for a little bit. But, I mean, like,
that's kind of owing to the nature of this film, where, I mean, as we've said before, like, it's a pretty thin one. I mean, it seems odd placing this in a conversation against something like White Dog that has a lot going on in multiple different registers of the text, and it's asking a lot of challenging questions. Here, we have, like, a good spooky story that ends up being, oh, well, it turns out she just wanted money. The end. I don't know, it feels kind of underwhelming, and maybe it's because, like, it's the one that isn't strictly adapted from Poe. Like, there's nothing iconic in the story itself, like, points that it needs to hit on, or images that it needs to, that we all remember, as opposed to, you know, like, the titular pendulum in The Pit and the Pendulum, or even just aspects of The Raven and that. Like, the iconography here isn't clearly established, so it's difficult to sort of, while you're watching it, to figure out where this film is going or what it wants to be. And even by the time it's over, it's still kind of difficult to answer that. I will say, though, there's one sequence that we probably should talk about, because stylistically, it is very different and very, very modern in a sense. And that is that weird dream sequence.
Yeah. Which is, yeah, no, basically, at a point in the film, Guy ends up having this dream where he, in the dream, which has this lovely multiple optical filters sort of placed overlaid over top of it.
Yeah, it's sort of like a dark-hued kaleidoscope.
Yeah, and what ends up happening is after that sequence where we see the tricked-out crypt, he has a dream where he basically experiences every precaution that he's set up in this crypt fail miserably. There, you know, the dynamite's crumbled and turned to dust. The lever stopped working. The ladder that he was supposed to be able to climb out of up the stairs, you know, falls down and he can't get it back up there. And the cup of poison, which was supposed to be his last get-out clause, is full of maggots rather than the poison. So, yeah, it's...
Yeah, explain that one. Did they drink it? Did they somehow just get stronger?
It's a dream, Andrew. We don't have to explain logic here. But yeah, no, but it's very stylish in the way it's done. Like, I mean, it very much... think the opening credits of the 1966 Batman movie, except with a lot more cobwebs and additional sort of hazy filters thrown on top of it.
And it's a lot of POV shots as well.
Yeah, definitely, like, when he goes to drink the cup, yeah, you see right into the cup rather than just seeing the maggots spill onto his face or something like that. Probably because Ray Milland wasn't going to allow maggots falling on his face. I don't blame him. But, you know, it's a very stylish and probably, arguably, the creepiest sequence in the film. Like, I mean, yeah, the skeleton falling into Guy's arms is a nice jump scare if you don't know what's coming. But for the most part, I think anybody reasonably watching a film at that point is like, okay, something's going to happen as soon as he opens that door.
I wonder why all this music is swelling.
Yeah, whereas, you know, the dream sequence is legitimately weird out. And again, it's one of the few times where it's like, okay, we're diving into this guy's psychosis, as it were, and just seeing, you know, how far down the road of what he's up, how far down the road he is in terms of how paranoid he's become. Certainly more so than his painting in his own crypt indicates. But,
yeah, but I mean, like, the sequence really stands out as, like, on a technical level, it's very, like, that's the one area where it's like, okay, well, here's where we're sort of moving from a purely, like, classical, like, period drama. Here we're using, like, some very, very contempo techniques and technology. And I feel like if this film was going to be sold on anything, like, probably this was the sequence shown to, like, investors or, like, you know, the one that everybody ended up coming home talking about, because it does stand out. And it's a fairly lengthy sequence. Like, doesn't it run, like, 6 or 7 minutes? Or maybe it just felt like that? I remember feeling it's quite long, given the fact that the film itself is pretty short.
It's probably about 3 to 4 at most, I would say. But, it definitely is an extended dream. As far as most of the scenes in this movie goes, it plays a little bit longer than most. And yeah, no, it's
like, that's the problem though, because it's a lengthier scene. It's very ornate, very stylized, but it also ends up being completely peripheral. You know, we get that sense that he's still worried all of his fail safes are going to fail, and spoiler alert, well, in a roundabout way, they kind of do, but I mean, they don't really, this doesn't motivate anything further, necessarily. So it's like, it's a whole lot of pomp and circumstance, in a way, where it doesn't lead to any dramatic change to the narrative. It's a thing that happens, and while it's cool to look at, it's like, well, but what is this doing, really, on a narrative level?
And again, I would say you're not wrong, but I think when it comes to this film in particular, you know, the charms of it come less from any sense of real innovation and, you know, firm greatness, as it were, as opposed to it's going through the motions, but it's doing them in an entertaining enough fashion. And I mean, it's like a warm bath movie, with maggots, but a warm bath movie nonetheless. Where,
and to its credit, like, in the context of Corman, I can also see, like, if you went to see 5 movies that week in 1962, like, regardless of what the other ones were, you'd at least walk out of the theater and you would remember that sequence of this one. And I mean, that's really more the goal here. Again, it's about getting audiences in and getting them talking about, like, the crazy, weird things that happen in this. So even if it's just, like, a single sequence, that was enough for some filmmakers to really, like, stake their wagon to.
And there's also, I think, something to be said about the fact that, I mean, from a contemporary perspective, this really is the kind of horror movie that doesn't really get made anymore. Because so much of the horror genre has gone to, particularly, and I think Joe Dante on the the special features of the disc I watched makes a good point about, you know, in 1962, this was the film that was being targeted towards teenagers, and it's starring people who are in their, you know, 50s in a period piece. Could you see that happening now? And odds are you really can't, because, you know, most of our contemporary horror films of that nature are very much these, you know, of the moment, very much taking place at this time and dealing with fears that don't necessarily lend themselves to the same kind of atmospheric quality you get out of a period horror film like this. And I think that's one of the things that the horror genre in total has really struggled with, is that in a digital era where everything is clean and filtered and, you know, very crisp, that sort of analog and vibe, I guess, for lack of a better descriptor at this point in time, does not exist.
Yeah, because you compare this to something like The Others, for instance.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's really playing off of, like, the sort of gothic high melodrama period tropes, but filtered through, like, contemporary filmmaking, like, you end up getting a very different film than you do here. And not just because, like, the visual distinction between the two is, like, night and day. But, and then, I mean, they ended up making that John Cusack film, The Raven,
which, God.
You know, wants to be a period piece, but has absolutely no idea what it's doing at any point. But yeah, like, this is, it feels like, this is really kind of, like, in that Hammer horror vein, where they're, you can see the grain on the film, but there's a certain warmth that comes with that. And you're right, it is a style of filmmaking through and through, both, you know, from the ground up as a production and the overall look and feel of the finished film, that really doesn't get made anymore. But I'd say if that's the reason we're telling people to check this out, I mean, they can look at the other 7 films that Roger Corman made adapting Edgar Allan Poe's works, and they would probably be a little bit more enjoyable. I mean, this film's weird. It's silly. I mean, I certainly didn't mind watching it. It went by very quickly. I don't know. It's, I don't think I can say there's anything terribly essential about this one.
Well, no, I would never make the argument that this is the lost masterpiece that nobody has, that you have to see, or, you know, this is an underappreciated gem. It's just, you know, it's a stock production. But, you know, there is something to be said for that. And I mean, certainly, as, you know, a bit of an off tangent, if you're a sucker like me who loves going through sort of the minutia of these things, it's worth taking a look at it for seeing how Corman sort of veers off of some of what you would typically see in his other Poe films here, for that thing, which I admittedly, that doesn't suddenly make this an innately better experience. But again, if that's the kind of film fan you are, you're not going to regret that experience here. And again, at worst comes to worst, if you're just looking, you know, to program a night of, you know, horror films that aren't necessary. I mean, if you're not into, you know, looking for, like, straight edge horror where it's trying to terrify you to your straight to the bone, you know, this is the kind of fun film that you can throw in on Halloween night and have a good time with, if nothing else. And, you know, I gotta say, I appreciate that kind of thing when it comes to these movies. So, yes,
I think you made the case well, though. And I mean, this is a film that can be appreciated and fondly watched, in spite of its obvious limitations. But that being said, David, I mean, I think it wouldn't suit us well to talk about this film for a longer time than the film takes to play on screen. So, do you have any final words to wrap this one up?
Not really. I mean, I think I've said my piece. I mean, what about you, Andrew? Anything before we turn to hits and pits, assuming we really have any this week?
I think, honestly, Dave, you said it best. And I think, like, especially because people like Roger Corman, you know, maybe don't necessarily get the credit that they deserve, not necessarily for their films themselves, but just for the role they played within the American film industry. It's always interesting to see where it came from. And at the end of the day, like, this is not a perfect film, but I can also see myself, like, living in California and being 18 years old and thinking, hey, you know, I could do this. And then realizing, oh, it's just as simple as going to Roger Corman's office, talking to him, and making it happen. So it's interesting in that regard, because, like, this does feel very workmanlike and like a film anybody can make. And, you know, the moment that you're watching, like, The Tree of Life at the multiplex, well, it's suddenly a little bit more difficult to have that same feeling. So, kudos, Roger, for all the audiences that you terrified and for all the brave young filmmakers that you helped give a start to. And that being said, it's now time for our patent-pended Hits and Pits bumper segment. So, David, this is a film full of little quirks, so I'm sure you can think of at least one. Are there any aspects that we didn't cover in the discussion proper?
Good question, and I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking this one through. I mean, we never really did talk much about Richard Nye's performance as Miles Archer. I mean, he gets basically the throwaway role of, you know, third party in this drama that's basically there to, well, support the friend and provide advice from time to time. But he does it well, even though it looks like he could be aged anywhere from like 26 to, you know, 53. And I would believe it if somebody said it. Like, there's something about the cragginess of his face.
He carries himself well, though, because, yeah, I mean, when he's acting as a friend, we take him at his word. And, you know, his scenes with Emily, you know, they have a fairly decent amount of chemistry. And by the end, you know, you genuinely get the feeling that he's upset that his friends are dead. So on that front, you know, he does the job.
Exactly. But what about you, Andrew? What any hits from you that we haven't mentioned?
I would say just in terms of specifically within the music and the sound design of this film, I really liked the part where Guy is alone and then he thinks he hears whistling coming from outside and he runs through the manor home trying to find the source of it, and it gets louder and then all of a sudden it disappears. But then the wind starts blowing in, but it's mixed in such a way that you can hear the melody in the blowing of the wind. It's very subtle, and in fact, it's like probably the most understated thing about this film, but it's deployed to good effect, and the recurring motif of the whistling, I think it is effective. You know, it's just like, it adds very nicely to the overall atmosphere of eeriness. Anything else from you, Dave?
We never mentioned the cat scene, which is, you know, just the lead into him going down into his father's grave. There's a moment where the cat's stuck in the wall, and which is kind of like being buried alive, and therefore kind of triggers another episode for Guy there. And it's just sort of delightful as you have Ray Milland, you know, acting his heart out, trying to make you feel this moment where everybody's just sort of like, ooh, can we press in the little, you know, part of the wall here and try and get the kitty out? It's adorable, and again, not a great recommendation, but I will recommend that moment.
It's also a callback to Poe's more famous story, The Black Cat, as well. I mean, Poe had he seems himself to have a real thing about things getting buried or put behind walls.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Anything else that you would like to sort of praise as a hit, or should we move on to some pits?
I would also just like to give a special nod to Alan Napier, specifically when it's revealed that Dr. Galt, has hired these men to dig up a guy, and, like, he's basically giving, like, his Bond villain monologue to what he thinks is a corpse.
Yes.
But he has that phrase, what is it? He's like, oh, Guy, you contributed nothing to science in your life, but in death, you will give it its greatest rewards.
Yeah.
I'm like, come on, Alfred, this is so unlike you. But, like, that's one of those lines of dialogue where it's like, it hits that sort of, that beautiful overlap between high camp and ridiculous brilliance.
Yeah.
I just wish there was more of it.
Yeah, no.
But for Pitts, Are there any aspects where this film goes wrong that we haven't talked about?
Not enough Dick Miller. That's mainly it. Yeah, I mean, we got Dick Miller here. He's fine, but he doesn't get nearly enough to do, as much to do here, as he, you know, was clearly capable of doing so much more. But hey, any Dick Miller is good Dick Miller. I'll take Dick Miller.
Yeah, it's. I mean, they certainly have a serviceable cast. It's just none of them are given anything terribly interesting to do, and it's all overshadowed by Raymalan having histrionics every 4 minutes.
Yeah, it is. But yeah, that's my first pit, and maybe only pit. What about you, Andrew? Anything we haven't touched upon yet?
Shrug. I mean, like, this is the kind of film where it's like, well, you can pick out all the elements, like, oh, well, Ray Milland is clearly breathing after he's dead. But, like, that's beside the point. It
Yeah.
seems kind of excessive. I mean, we've already said our piece on this one, so I think I'm all out of pits.
As am I. So yeah, that's Premature Burial. It is reasonably easy to get your hands on. The Blu-ray released by Kino Lorber is well worth your time if you're interested in acquiring a copy of this thing. It looks good.
And
But
failing that, just buy one of those retro movie channels and just wait for Halloween, because I'm sure it's going to get played at least once.
I'm sure, yeah, this TV will have it on air. Like I said, I'm pretty sure MGM's the one that has control over it. Yeah, that it'll show up, folks. But with that, I relinquish the wheel to you, Andrew.
Oh, why, thank you, kind sir. Yeah, I guess so for next week. How are we going to follow this up? Well, I think given this film tries to be very suspenseful and doesn't quite manage to stick the landing, I realize that if we follow Heather Angel, who plays Jane in this film, we can follow her to a little film called Suspicion, directed by, oh, little known cat by the name of Alfred Hitchcock. So next week we'll be looking at Suspicion with Cary Grant, which it's proof positive that any film that tries to do the is he or isn't he ambiguity and it falls apart at the end, there is a way that you can sustain that. It's probably not as fondly remembered as Hitchcock's other more notable works, but I think it does a lot of interesting things. Haven't seen it for a while, and I'd be very, very eager to go through it again, especially if I get to talk about it with you, Dave. So that looks like where we're going.
Absolutely fantastic. So yeah, so watch for that, or wait, pay attention for that fairly soon. Until then, where can they contact you if the hardcore Premature Burial fans want to scream at us, Andrew?
You can find me on Twitter at FilmsTripper, and you, Dave?
I'm at 24 Panels, also on Twitter, though you could also rate and review us on iTunes. 5 stars, please. Although, again, I guess if you're coming to scream at us, beggars can't be choosers for the kind of rating you're going to give us.
Well, 5-star reviews are the best way to increase our visibility in the listings and that, and help us grow a bigger audience. But as we often say, if you don't tell us what we're doing wrong, then we can't do anything about it. So, your feedback is crucial, and at the end of the day, we want to make the kind of show that you folks want to listen to. So, and again, website update. I have oral confirmation. It's only held up because my friend who's offered to do it refuses to accept money for it. So hopefully we can sort this out and hopefully get some content, maybe some blogs, or at least an episode archive up on the web. The more ways you can get a hold of us, probably the better.
Absolutely. So, with that, Andrew, any parting words you would like to leave our listeners with?
I do have some parting words. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Although it could be a cataleptic state, so, bear that in mind.